Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Derek Bros here, and I'm just gonna do a little walk and talk today for a video that I wanted to do about the Vice clip. For those of you who haven't seen it, Vice recently put out an interview, which I'm featured in, about quote unquote anti-vaxxers moving to communes, whatever that means, in Mexico. And obviously, you guys know I've been in Mexico, I've been helping people move to Mexico for a couple of years now. And this is something I feel strongly about, so we're gonna talk about it. Check this out.
This is Derek Bros. This is Derek Bros of the Conscious Resistance. I'm here in Standing Rock.
That man is wanted in 5 different countries: Chile, Argentina, Brazil.
We've been fighting a long time. We have all lost so very much. So many loved ones gone.
Don't you fucking tease that horse!
You are not alone. There are pockets of resistance all around the planet. We are at the brink. Above all, stay alive. You have no idea how important you are. Are you listening to this? You are the resistance.
So, yeah, as I said, I was interviewed by Vice News back in February. And I actually asked a lot of my audience about this. And, you know, of course, most of you were adamantly against it, which I understood. It wasn't that I was confused about why I wouldn't want to talk to Vice. But ultimately, I believe in my ability to communicate the message effectively. And I'm not Alex Jones. I'm not going to flip out, go all crazy. Excuse the wind. So I felt pretty confident about my ability to talk to them. So in February, I was in Acapulco for Agorapulco, not Anarchapulco. I don't support or participate in Anarchapulco, but Agorapulco, sort of shepherded by my buddy Bruce out in Denver. Shout out to We Are Change Colorado. Is the one who has facilitated this the last couple years. And Agorapulco is like a more decentralized version of Anarchapulco. So it's free. It doesn't cost $1,200 just to attend. It doesn't cost $15 for a bottle of water, all that kind of stuff you might find at Anarchapulco. And I agreed to be interviewed by Vice, and I told them that I was going to record my part of the conversation, and that's what I'm going to share with you guys today. But for those of you who haven't seen the Vice report, I'll go ahead and link it in the description. You can go check it out. But here's the most important part, the part that actually affects me. So check this out. This is the 2 minutes out of the hour-long conversation I had with the Vice reporter, Alice. And this is the 2 minutes they use. So check it out first.
Some of those organizing outside the festival grounds are intellectual purists. They distrust not just government, but also corporations and big tech. Since 2015, Derek Bros has been helping others, quote, exit the system by creating small anarchist communities called freedom cells.
A freedom cell is a decentralized way of organizing in your community focused on skill sharing, knowledge sharing, figuring out how they can grow food together, figuring out how they can educate each other better. If the people involved are all parents, then the Freedom Cell might take a focus on homeschooling, unschooling. If the Freedom Cell is people who are very focused on permaculture, then that might be their focus. A lot of groups, like I'd say...
How many people would you estimate are exiting their countries to build a new life in Mexico and also Latin America?
I might even be underestimating, but I've seen through my own networks of helping people through our caravans, driving people down what we call the Underground Railroad, helping people come here, and then just people through the Freedom Cell Network, it's definitely somewhere 5,000 to 10,000 people, I'd say, that have made Mexico their home in different parts.
The word Underground Railroad obviously has a lot of historical context, and there's a lot of language that I think viewers watching might find inappropriate or a bit disrespectful to the original context of those words. I don't know if you want to speak to that.
When the original conductors in the railroad helped slaves escape, they had to make a decision knowing that it was against the Fugitive Slave Act, that they could go to prison for it. And in that same sense, many of us now feel like it's up to us, those of us who have the ability, to help other people who feel like they're escaping from situations that are not amenable to freedom. So we started putting out the call. It's through the Freedom Cell Network too. People sign up through there. They get an email that says, hey, there's a caravan coming up soon. If you're interested, you got to fill out this survey. There's a vetting process, and then we just help people who want to come down.
Do you think this is going to continue?
I think this is just the beginning, honestly.
But the pandemic restrictions are loosening.
for those of us who see that this is just the excuse to accelerate the push to what Klaus Schwab, the head of the World Economic Forum, calls the fourth industrial revolution, which is a push towards AI, social credit scores, facial recognition, blockchain being used in some really scary ways. You know, that vision is why, you know, I'm not going to go home even if things chill out.
So that's the 2 minutes that they used. And honestly, I think I did pretty good. I stand by everything I said. Of course, with the whole overall report, it was designed to make people look crazy. Even just calling it anti-vaxxers are building communes out in Mexico and stuff like that. Or I think at one point the title was the anti-vaxxer Burning Man or something silly like that. That's what, you know, about the level of seriousness we expect from Vice. But they started out the video report with people who are spiritual types, which I am myself. But they've tried to use clips that they thought would be the most embarrassing or make people look the craziest. And then, of course, they end with somebody who is denying the Holocaust. And, you know, whatever your thoughts on that, that's pretty far out of the mainstream for most people. And so it has the effect of making anything that I might have said that makes sense appear to be crazy, just like the other crazy people, right? And this is the way that Vice operates. So it is not really anything new or surprising. It's just kind of what was expected. And so, yeah, I went into this fully knowing that this is probably what Vice is going to do. That's why I recorded the whole conversation myself. But also, as I've mentioned, I feel and felt pretty confident in my ability to communicate the message. So I don't feel bad for doing it. So there's people, it's kind of been weird. There's people in the Mexico Freedom Cells who've been debating this for the last week. Some of them who are attacking me or saying this was a mistake and I shouldn't have talked to Vice and this and that. But guys, maybe you are scared or you guys live in fear, but I don't. I feel confident in my ability to talk about these ideas. And I know that overall, Vice's audience is totally brainwashed for a large part. But at the same time, I know that there are people who probably do align with us and have questions who still watch Vice. So those are the people that I did this for. I didn't do this for my own ego. There's people saying, oh, the only reason anybody would do this is if they wanted to stroke their own ego. Or, I don't know, maybe if you care about getting the message and the ideas out to more than just our own circles and doing more than just having a circle jerk, maybe then you might talk to new people. That's at least how I approach it, guys, is I'm not afraid to speak to the mainstream, including Vice. Anyways, though, so what she did there in our interview was she tried to make the Underground Railroad name, which is what Miriam and I call our caravans helping people down to Mexico, which are totally legal at the moment, but also, which I wrote in my book, How to Opt Out of the Technocratic State, that I imagine will eventually be illegal and will be literally underground, covertly done. And Alice tried to make it sound as if this was, you know, cultural appropriation. I guess they, you know, tried to make it sound like we're appropriating slavery from the slaves. And I'm sure there's somebody who thinks that's racist or whatever, but the reality is if you're coming from a place like Canada, Australia, where you can't travel, you can't work, you are being locked in your homes, that's not freedom. That's slavery. And people are running away from that. So, like it or not, it's the Underground Railroad. And more specifically, and you'll hear this context, and in fact, maybe I'll just go ahead and play it, the context of what I specifically answered her when she said, you know, what do you think to people who say that using Underground Railroad is offensive?
So you call your caravans out of Canada the Underground Railroad?
They're coming out of the U.S., yeah, out of the U.S. We have people who come from Canada to the U.S., but yeah, it's called the Modern Underground Railroad / Counter-Economic Underground Railroad, and it's just terminology from my book, How to Opt Out of the Technocratic State. Again, I published that book at the beginning of 2020, and I was writing in there a chapter about how in a distant future, not too distant future, there might be a time where, like the original Underground Railroad, people sought, you know, to travel to places that they find more free or more amenable to their lifestyle, and what that means in the sense of, again, surveillance, facial recognition, social credit score. And so the idea was just theorizing that this might be necessary at some point in the future. And then COVID happened, and it kind of evolved to becoming a still totally legal and above the board thing for the moment, but just a way to, for Miriam and I, because we were making the trip back and forth to Houston to down to Mexico, so we started putting out the call. It's through the Freedom Cell Network, too. People sign up through there.
They get an email that says, hey, there's a caravan coming up soon. If you're interested, you got to fill out this survey. There's a vetting process, but, and then we just help people who want to come down.
It just makes me wonder, the word Underground Railroad obviously has a lot of historical context, and it reminds me of a lot of conversations I've had this week with people who say, you know, in my home country in Canada or in the UK, like, I'm a slave. And I've also noticed that people who are moving here call themselves refugees.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of language that I think viewers watching might find inappropriate or a bit disrespectful to the original context of those words. I don't know if you want to speak to that.
A lot of people aren't aware that the original Underground Railroad had railways to Mexico as well, that slaves did escape to Mexico. And so for me, it's kind of a... I think it's like a continuation of that the same way, because I don't know how, I mean, whatever terms you want to use it, whether you want to call somebody a slave or a refugee or not, but people are, in some circumstances, Canada included, are literally running away from places where they can't work without getting the shot. They can't take their kids to school. They can't ride a bus. They can't take a plane. They can't, you know, and in some places, like France and other countries, people being denied entry into grocery stores without proof of vaccination. Like, those are some pretty dramatic and most of us would say authoritarian things. And so I can understand why somebody who's literally trying to get away from a place like that might consider themselves a refugee.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean they're running away from the Syrian crisis per se, but I can definitely understand. I mean, I wouldn't want to be in that environment. And, you know, so I would probably choose to leave as well, even though those aren't my specific circumstances. But yeah, and then in terms of like using the Underground Railroad in terms of like slavery, in the book, it's more related to the idea that the Underground Railroad was an act of counter-economics. And without having to get too deep into the weeds of that, it's essentially saying that when the original conductors in the railroad helped slaves escape, they had to make a decision knowing that it was against the Fugitive Slave Act, that they could go to prison for it. You know, people took bribes, cops looked the other way to help people make their way on there. And in that same sense, many of us now feel like it's up to us, those of us who have the ability, to help other people who feel like they're escaping from situations that are not amenable to freedom. Maybe you wouldn't call it abject slavery, you know, they're not chained by the hand. But yeah, I mean, so that, it was kind of more in the sense of like, this is an act of counter-economics because it's what the state says is illegal, and that's what agorism is all about. It doesn't matter if it's illegal, as long as it's nonviolent, if it's moral, then do it. And in that sense, we feel helping people come, whether from the U.S. or Canada, down to Mexico is part of that goal.
I don't think it's offensive because in my book I was writing about it in terms of counter-economics. For those who understand Samuel Konkin, counter-economics, then you might know that the idea of counter-economics is that if the state says something, says you shouldn't do something, and you're not hurting anybody, you're not violating any laws, you're not coercing anybody or forcing anybody, then there's really no harm and there's nothing, you know, you should do what you want. So if the state says drugs are illegal, but you are a business person who sells drugs, then you should do that either way, regardless of what the state says. And that is an act of counter-economics, part of the counter-economy or the informal economy. And the more of us who live and push into the counter-economy, the stronger we are, the less tax funds and power the state has. So that's what I was talking about, is that it's the counter-economic Underground Railroad, or the modern Underground Railroad, because all the people who chose to help slaves on the Underground Railroad in the past, and who are helping runaway slaves, refugees right now, those people are doing so even though they know there could be a risk. Right now there's no legal risk, but it's a social stigma. Oh my God, you're anti-vaxxer, etc. So those are acts of counter-economics. Of course, that's too complex and too layered for Vice to put it in there, so they cut that whole section out, and they want to try to trigger people to be offended by what I said. But in reality, there's nothing to be offended about, and even if you're in the Freedom community, Freedom Cell community, and you're upset that I did this, you know, if you want to live in fear, that's fine. If you're worried that people are going to know that there are communities thriving in Mexico, that's on you, but trust me, they already know. I've been shouting about it for 2 years, and I live in freedom. I live in empowerment. I'm not going to live in fear, and if you want to live in fear, that's up to you. But either way, guys, I just wanted to address the situation, and now I'm going to give you the full unedited interview from Vice and myself. Check it out, and let me know what your thoughts are, guys. And thank you so much again for continuing to support me. Please check out theconsciousresistance.com. If you can support my efforts, go to theconsciousresistance.com/invest. Send us something to my P.O. box. I'm excited. I'm in here in Texas. I'm going to be checking my P.O. box this month. Send me something fun, all right? Until next time, remember, you are powerful, you are beautiful, you are free. Peace.
Peace. Peace.
Cool. let's keep try to keep the if you can be as concise as possible, because it just helps us in the edit, and then we don't have to like try to make it shorter.
Yeah.
But what are your movements? What are the movements that you're a part of?
Well, I definitely, they're not my movements for sure, but any, I guess, movements that I'm involved in, if we were to label them, it could be things, broadly speaking, let's say spirituality, consciousness movement. Let's say crypto movement to some degree. You know, I've been reporting on and involved in crypto in different ways since 2012. The Freedom Cell movement, more specifically, the Greater Reset, you know. Broadly speaking, what's sometimes termed the truth movement, freedom movement, anarchist movement, different labels by different people, and then maybe by people outside the circles as conspiracy theorists or things like that. You know.
Interesting. So on one side you have the truth movement, and then on the other side you have the conspiracy movement. And what you're saying is that these are actually the same thing.
Yeah. Well, not like, obviously, like I was saying, there's some people within these movements who aren't very discerning, aren't very good at critical thinking, and do share things that are false, that even people in our own movements would say, dude, this is bullshit, you know. But yeah, outside of these circles, we probably would be seen by some people as just one lump of crazy conspiracy theorists, even though there's a lot of differences in there, you know.
Yeah, there's nuance.
Yeah,
there's
exactly.
Color.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because we were chatting with someone who is, I think, like a very like clear-headed guy. But he, you know, I was kind of surprised because, you know, he asked me whether I thought the Earth was a globe, and I was like, dude, I can't believe like you also are into that. But like, he was kind of explaining that once you start to question certain things, you become more open to questioning like many assumptions about the world. And he also says that he's not, you know, it's not that he just believes stuff on blind faith and it's every quote unquote conspiracy theory he's just going to believe. But I thought that was kind of interesting. Like, do you feel like that? What does it mean to question your reality?
I mean, I think it means different things for different people. I mean, I guess I should say I'm not a flat earther personally, but there's definitely people in the movement who feel that way. And sometimes things like that can be super divisive. Like, oh, you don't believe the same thing I do. You must be a shill kind of thing. It's silly. But generally speaking, like, I think that it is true that once you start to question the world around you, and you do that in a fact-based way for sure, that there's more than enough factual reality that doesn't line up with the cookie-cutter Disney version of the world that we're taught through the mainstream public school system. That doesn't mean you go all the way into the rabbit hole and you think it's flat, or I mean, for some people they go that far and they get into whoever they think is running things, you know. But I try to use my work specifically in my journalism to take it out of the realm of conspiracy and really approach it like true crime, because most of the things that do get called conspiracies have a factual basis. They have a root in, you know, in documented history. You know? And there are a lot of things that are just totally pulled out of wherever, but, you know.
When did you start to question things?
Probably my whole life. I mean, been questioning authority generally speaking, but you know, in these various movements, it's often referred to as like waking up, right? I didn't start waking up in the sense of questioning government, questioning corporations, looking into sort of a conspiratorial view of history until my early 20s. I started to wake up first because I got addicted to crystal meth and I went to prison when I was 20 years old, and that's where I discovered meditation, and that's where I started working on a lot of my trauma. And my family has a long history of drug abuse, so I come from a lot of that, and that was when I really first started to like question a lot of the assumptions. You know, I was already kind of anti-authority, but not really with any general, like without a purpose and not with any deep understanding of power or anything like that. So when I got out of prison after doing 18 months, I kind of came out and I was just, I guess, reborn in a way. I definitely started to heal a lot of things, meditation, different things like that. And I came out, I was also a felon now, so I was getting judged as a felon. I can't rent here, can't get a job here. And I started going to the library all the day, applying for jobs, and started reading books and learning about the drug war first. And then from there, just kind of started to like realize like this drug war version, this history I was learning isn't the version I was taught in school. And now I'm coming out as part of the drug war. And it just kind of piqued my interest of like, okay, well, what else? What other, you know, facts was I not taught in school or any of my, you know, my proper schooling? And that was kind of the beginning of just generally starting to question things. And then from there, it was like couple of different books, a documentary, you know, and then as you say, you go down the rabbit hole, and it definitely altered my way of thinking for sure.
Is questioning government like a major theme?
I think so, because I mean, the government
And generally speaking, like, government as an institution, like the state, I mean, I'm also an anarchist too, so, like, I don't just question them in terms of conspiracies that have happened, like Tuskegee and stuff like that, but I look at those things and also filter it through that. To my view, it's the state that's the problem, it's the government that's the problem. And there's definitely a lot of people, I would say, in these different movements that feel the same. I don't have a blind spot for corporations in there. I think it's more like a corporate state that's working together. And, you know, this is something I've documented through my documentary series called The Pyramid of Power, like looking at all these different institutions, the education system, the corporate media, the fake new media, which some people lump Vice in with, and BuzzFeed and others. But yeah, looking at how these things, again, from more of a true crime lens, not like, I don't need to go super deep and start making up conspiracy theories, because there's so much documented shit that people just don't know, or because of our assumptions, we assume that sounds too crazy to be reality. That sounds like it's a QAnon kind of thing. That sounds like whatever. I'm not even going to actually look into it, right? And for me, it's just always been about, there's pretty much no topic that I won't at least open my mind up to for a little bit. And then after a while, you're like, you know what? I don't see anything worth continuing. Flat Earth is one of those things for me. I'm just like, that's not my area. If you want to put your focus, go for it. But so I've spent a lot of time going down those rabbit holes. But really, for me, it's about the solutions that really matter. Like, you know, that's where we're at now, is people are coming to these events because they want solutions.
I want to ask you about those. But also, I'm just curious, like, because I'm just getting to know you a little better. I hope you don't mind. What rabbit holes are you in right now? Can you take me on a few?
The only thing that I've even had time to research right now is for my documentary series. So it's called The Pyramid of Power, and I'm on season 3. I've basically been releasing them like in episodes, 4 episodes a month. So we've released one in 2020, one last year, and we're working on a new one. And so I've been diving into things like the nonprofit industrial complex, as well as like foundations, like non-NGOs and other groups that actually serve to propagate messages, whether that's government messages or, you know, specific special interests or lobbying groups, but also kind of how on a deeper level, those groups actually affect and essentially rule the world to a large degree. Like these unseen groups that promote themselves as nonprofits, think tanks, NGOs, like the World Economic Forum, for example. They're like the big example everybody's very aware of right now, because they're the ones who announced the Great Reset. So like foundations, that's one chapter. Another chapter is going a deep dive on the banking system, the history of the Federal Reserve System. And then the last chapter of season 3 is going to be about the intelligence operations, like just the history from everything from like MKUltra to the Tuskegee to like overthrowing government secretly to funding propaganda campaigns to more current things. I mean, again, like there's so much documented evidence of all the malfeasance coming from governments and intelligence communities that you don't really have to make shit up.
You just go through the history of all the ways the government has fucked up, and you like remind people they had forgotten.
But also try to provide solutions. And every episode, I mean, all my work in general, but every episode of the documentary is transcribed with every source linked there to the primary documents, as well as my original interviews that I'm recording for it. And then I have suggested reading and documentaries to go, because it's actually like each episode is only 20, 25 minutes long. It's kind of taking a style of maybe Vice and some others. I'm trying to make it like bingeable. So it's taking a lot of history, condensing it down to just the finer points, suggested reading, here's some solutions, go further if you want to, you know.
Because your viewers want to do their research.
They do, absolutely. I mean, I don't, and also I stand by, like, my work, and I've worked for a lot of, like, independent media, you know, and more independent than, like, Vice even, right? Like, again, people who would be deemed conspiracy theorists. But I've been able to break a lot of stories, like, locally in Houston. I've been able to do a lot of important work for people who follow it. And as you know, like, your name is really all you have. So if I publish or write something that's garbage, like, people are going to call it out. And they're not going to trust me. Maybe there'll be suckers who would believe it if I wanted to go down that route. People who don't care about credibility or being accountable. But I do very much care about, like, my work and what I put my name attached to. So if there's a documentary or a book or an article, I stand by it. You know?
How do you make money?
I get paid for my articles. I write for The Last American Vagabond, and that's like a monthly gig. So I write a few articles a month, and I have a monthly income. And then when I do events, I sell my books and shirts. And there's, my most recent book has been the most popular, so it's a couple hundred dollars coming in here and there every few months from the publisher and things like that. But mostly it's through writing.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Okay, that's great.
Most of the stuff isn't paying me anything. I have a radio show in Houston that's not a paid gig. I have all the, you know, but it's the writing and the books and stuff.
I don't know what your lifestyle is like, but it seems like maybe that's something that's not the most important thing to you.
No, it's not. I mean, my lifestyle is very much outside of the system as much as possible, so I don't really have, I live a very my standard of living is high because my cost of living is low. Like, you know, I came to Mexico to save money to get land and to be closer to where I think the next wave of, you know, this movement is going to be. But also, it does allow me the freedom to travel, like my type of work. As you know, like, I can kind of, if I feel the call to, like, dedicate my time to a specific story, then I can just focus on traveling for that purpose. Or I can travel to do tours, speaking tours, or I can just, you know, stay home and just work from behind the computer if I want to, which is really where I prefer to be. Other than in person doing reporting, I'd rather just be home doing my own thing. But it's part of the work.
Yeah, I relate. So are there any institutions that you do trust?
Like public institutions?
We talked about nonprofits, we talked about government,
corporations. That's not to paint them all with a bad brush per se, right? Like, not every nonprofit or NGO is part of this machine. I mean, that's a little bit, I think, simplistic, right? So there, I can't think of any off the top of my head, but there might be some, I know a lot of people in the movement, for example, who are people who believe in the power of crypto and blockchain, and maybe they're starting nonprofits or companies that are trying to do good in the world, right? I put faith in those people that I can trust and things like that. And I'm sure there are other groups on the ground level that are really trying to do good, tangible things. But a lot of people also get caught up in specifically that nonprofit industrial complex, and their activism gets sucked away, and they realize they're working for, you know, other people than they thought. So I don't know. I mean, I put most of my faith in other people, not in faceless institutions, you know.
You're saying you don't trust institutions, but you trust some of the people that run them.
I might trust, I mean, maybe if I had time to sit down with every individual, I'd get to know them better, right? But I mean, also, I trust people who have a cleaner track record, I guess, right? Like, I'm not going to just trust Amazon. I'm not going to just trust, the Clinton Foundation or the World Economic Forum.
So it's size that matters to you?
No, it's not size. It's more about intent. Because there could be a small nonprofit or a small NGO that on the surface is doing some good work, but maybe they're funded by people that they don't realize have different actual interests and have a bigger goal, you know? And there's a lot of people who do, I think, operate in that way, who their intentions might be positive and good, but perhaps they're being used in ways they don't even realize. I mean, it kind of happens to us all in different ways, I think. Yeah.
So, do you think that there are good people in government?
I'm sure there are. I don't believe government as a tool is an effective way to organize human life. But that doesn't mean I think every single person who is in a local county office or city council position is, you know, part of the machine per se. But I also do see how the power that starts at the federal level and even the international level, you can see how it trickles down and up from the local level. Like, I ran for mayor of Houston in 2019 and got to see firsthand, like, how they treat somebody who has alternative ideas, which were pretty mainstream, honestly. I was just talking about, like, ending police surveillance, decriminalizing cannabis, building community gardens, and doing things like that. But even that was, like, seen as a threat, where I had to, like, threaten them with, like, hey, FCC requirements say you have to give me equal airtime, blah, blah, whatever. But I could see, even on that local level, there was already, like, power entrenched in these Houston Republican groups, Houston Democratic groups. Thankfully, I didn't have to align with any party. I just ran as me. But you could see, even on the local level, how there was already setting this tone of, there's only 5 candidates running. In reality, there's 12 running. But the local media, which is owned by bigger companies, never reports more than just these 5 people. And every time somebody hears about it, they only hear there's 5 candidates. And in reality, there's 13 of us. And so just little things like that I could see, like, okay, it's not just big power. It can be smaller local power that can be corrupted too, for sure. I mean, I think that's the whole thing about being an anarchist, is we recognize that humans are corruptible. That the answer isn't to, like, put other humans above us and assume they're going to be perfect, or, you know, they're going to figure it out. Like, instead, try to figure out how we can all take more personal responsibility for our own lives and come together collectively and do better things without that institution.
You kind of, I think this might be the answer to my question, but I'm not sure, so
sure.
I'm going to ask it again, which
sure.
is, like, so you don't think government is an effective way to organize people. So what is?
I think it'll look different in different places, right? I mean, we can't really predict that. I was sharing earlier, here in Mexico, about 2 hours away from where I live in Morelia, and in Cherón, 2 hours away, they just celebrated last year their 10-year anniversary of kicking out the cartel, the corrupt cops, the politicians. They've banned all political parties for the last 10 years. They went back to their indigenous form of governance. When I interviewed with them and talked with them, they said they believed they were successful because they had a common culture and a common connection that, you know, united them despite their differences. they also said that they felt like their community was whole before the political parties came, because political parties had only been in that part of the country for like 20 years. And they very quickly saw how it was dividing their people and turning them against each other. And so they have their way of organizing based on their indigenous traditions. But if we imagine what people will organize without government, it's going to look different in different places. And that's kind of why we focus on decentralization, is like, I can't tell another person what their community should organize like based on their resources, their needs, their environment, their, you know, their desires, etc. So I think that people who try to, you know, have prescriptions for what the future stateless society might look like are bound to fail, you know, are doomed to fail, because in the ideal situation, you would have a flourishing of human diversity. And maybe some people would choose to still live under the state, but those of us who don't want to should have the ability to, you know, break free from that and say, hey, well, we're going to go out on our own. We won't want any of your welfare, your systems. We want to build our own. And, you know, none of us know what that looks like, but I think that's what we're witnessing with all of the COVID and the Great Reset. So many people are kind of looking for a way to get out of these systems now. And that's something that I've been focusing on for years, not using banking systems, not dealing with the tax system as much as possible, and things like that. And now people see the value of that, because they think if they stay in those systems, they're going to be forced to get vaccinated. They're going to be forced to, you know, whatever it may be. And so my point with that long-winded answer is that, like, I think it's hard to know what comes next, but ultimately we're just trying to say, let's start building and see what comes out, you know?
I think that's really good. I think we should, like, talk about that same thing again, because that's, like, really the focus of our story is
sure.
People who are trying to create something new, but also they're fleeing something, right?
Yeah.
So I'm trying to think about how to set it up. Like, so you've been talking about, like, exiting the system of governments, the system of banking, all of these different systems for a long time. Is that right?
Yeah, for about 10 years or so. Yeah, maybe a little longer.
Has it caught on more recently?
It's caught on since 2020, like the beginning. March 2020 to be exact. It's whenever there's been a lot more interest. I published a book called How to Opt Out of the Technocratic State January 31st, 2020, and it talks about this idea of exiting and building. Exiting from systems which don't align with your values and your principles, and building better ones. And so that's like in the sense of like, hey, I don't like Google, so I'm not going to use their search engine anymore. To, I don't like what's happening in the city, I'm going to go buy land and build something better. You know, so it's kind of works in multiple arenas. But I self-published that book in January 2020. COVID came along and people started to pay attention to it, because it was sort of, I don't want to say predicting, but it was just, anybody with a brain who is in anywhere in the journalism field paying attention to digital surveillance could foresee the problems coming ahead with AI, facial recognition, etc. I mean, Vice has talked about it. There's plenty of people who could see that. So this book was kind of thinking, seeing that in the not too distant future, how does one remain free from those systems if things like social credit scores come into common usage, and now vaccine passports or mass facial recognition and all these different things, which is essentially the end of digital or of privacy and of anonymity and things like that. So I was kind of imagining, what does it look like to stay free with those systems emerging? And it's all influenced by the philosophy of agorism and counter-economics, which is a lot of my work focuses on. And the guy who kind of created it, he died in 2004, but I've taken a lot of inspiration from his work and have just been promoting that and kind of bringing it into the digital age. And so, yeah, my book was my ideas around that, and then publishing his final unfinished book, and it's just kind of taken off. And so now that phrase exit and build has kind of become common parlance in some circles, and people understand like what it means, and people started wanting to come to Mexico. And yeah,
when I started researching the story, I used Telegram a lot, and I came across like this Mexico exit concept a ton, and I also came across the concept of freedom cells. Like, there was a quote unquote freedom cell in Telegram in like every city in Mexico I looked at.
Yeah.
So what happened there?
COVID happened. I mean, in truth, the response to COVID, the government response to COVID around the world, right? Because it wasn't just COVID itself, that situation. It was more governments deciding to lock down, governments deciding to start talking about checking cars going state to state, examples of governments arresting people for not, you know, choosing to quarantine, and all these different stories that really, again, woke up a lot of people to saying, like, hey, there's something going on here. And I would say that these movements have seen exponential growth in those last 2 years. I mean, I don't know how to quantify that, but let's say 5 to 10 times, where people who before might have just been normie, average people are like asking all these questions, and then they've kind of come into the fold, learning about these events, learning about Freedom Cells. And Freedom Cells, since 2016 when I got involved and I started promoting it, has just been about encouraging people to get organized on a local basis in a decentralized way. You know, it's all focused on solutions, really. It's nothing really crazy. It's just like grow your own food, you know, prepare for an emergency. That could be a weather emergency, or it could be something scarier, you know, right? Whatever that may mean, but you kind of have this core group of people that you work together, like an activist support group, essentially. And the idea was there, and I've been talking about it, and some people got it, but it wasn't until COVID, when a lot of people felt threatened, that the website and the movement kind of went from about 2,000 people to over 30,000 people on the website, and probably, I would say, 40,000 people at large between Telegram and our website and just people who are doing it. And yeah, and it's because people, I think, want solutions. A lot of people in these movements have heard about the problems for so long, and they hear that the government's doing this, or the corporations are doing this, or this is happening to the environment, or, you know, whatever it may be. And after a while, it's just like you've heard it all. You've gone down all those rabbit holes. You've done all that thing. It's like, okay, so what are we going to do about it? And there's not too many people proposing any solutions in these movements. So I think that's another reason, is that Freedom Cells has been very consistently, myself and others, like promoting, like, guys, let's find each other. Let's get organized locally. Let's see how we can support each other. And I saw in 2020, and when I did the activation tour in the U.S. last fall, that, I mean, we had 90 to 100 people showing up at every event. We had 150 people in San Francisco where they already have vaccine passports. Again, people reacting to what's going on locally, looking for solutions. And everywhere we went, people were saying, I found these folks through Freedom Cells. Now we're buying land together. We pulled our kids out of the public school system together. We pulled our money out of the banks together. We're buying land together, you know, and they used the Freedom Cell groups or the website as just a way to connect at a time when a lot of people really felt alone, you know. I think probably most people, whatever their views are on COVID, felt alone during the last 2 years. But for people who've been questioning things, it's even more of an isolating experience. I feel like I can't, you know, people have told me, my kids don't want to talk to me because they think I'm crazy. My parents don't want to talk to me because they think I'm crazy. I lost everybody in my friend circle. I've lost friends that I've known, activists that I've worked side by side with. But COVID was like a very, you know, kind of divisive thing. And so for a lot of these people, they felt alone, and Freedom Cells offered a way for them to find other people, whether that's in their home countries or here in Mexico, where it's really growing rapidly.
Was it your idea, Freedom Cells?
I was second in line. My buddy John Bush, he's an activist from Texas. He's the first one to kind of promote the idea of organizing in groups of eight and calling it Freedom Cells. I heard him speak in Austin in 2015. And at that time, he was just calling it the Central Texas Mutual Aid Society. And then he had kids, and I just kind of took on the idea and really ran with it and started doing it in Houston. And yeah, it's just been kind of slow and steady growth until the last 2 years.
So more accurate would be, it would be accurate then to say that you popularized the idea.
Yeah, we call ourselves the co-founders, John and I. That was like, you came up with the name, I pushed it out there into the world, we'll just call ourselves co-founders.
Do you ever see it like getting twisted in ways you didn't intend?
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, one of the biggest things people are concerned about, especially in those movements, there's a lot of defeatism, there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of people like, well, if we get our own land or we start growing our own food, they're just going to come Waco us. They're going to come kill us all. Or, you know, there's like realistic concerns and stuff like that. And so people get trapped in that fear of like, well, what if somebody infiltrates the Freedom Cell movement, you know? And I was giving a presentation earlier, and I was making it clear that we have like three or maybe four main principles of the Freedom Cell Network. It's apolitical, it's solutions focused, it's decentralized, and it's nonviolent. Like, that's one thing that we don't admin or have any control over any of the groups. But if somebody were to like start using the name Freedom Cells to advocate storming the Capitol or something, we would very quickly disassociate. And if they were connected to any of our network, we would remove them and things like that. So that's one fear, is that because we are a decentralized movement, any crazy person could say, hey, I'm with the Freedom Cell, and go act crazy and then claim to be associated with us. And,
but it seems to be more about like checking out and like building your own thing.
It's definitely trying to build something new.
Like, trying to like reform or even abolish government.
Exactly. It's not like, I think a lot of us would like to see the government not exist in an ideal world, but also at the same time, rather than, again, there's many strategies, right? Some people, they try to go run for the Libertarian Party or the Green Party or start a new party, right?
That's what you did, right?
Well, in Houston, I ran specifically to spread a message, like to spread these ideas. I had no intention or hope of winning. I was, in fact, kind of scared once we started to get some support. I was like, oh my God, this might actually happen. But beyond that, beyond using politics as a way to spread a message, like, we definitely aren't trying to encourage people to reform the system. Agorism and counter-economics and exit and build is specifically, it's anti-political, It's nonviolent, and it's the whole strategy is built around competing with the systems directly, not trying to outvote them or throw them out, not trying to violently overthrow them, so we're the guys in power, but compete with them directly by building new systems.
I think that's why you maybe pointed out that the strategy of like doing maskless protests at convenience stores in the area is not your favorite, because you would rather just not go to that business in the first place.
I mean, well, I think that, that is right. It's 100% right, because a lot of people in these movements that are here might consider themselves libertarians or anarchists, or people who are the kind of people who would say, let's vote with our dollar, right? Like, let's not buy from Monsanto, right? Let's support local businesses. And so, to me, just harassing some like local store clerk who has absolutely no power over the situation, you know, whether I agree with them or not, isn't going to achieve any, like, what goal does that achieve? It doesn't move my actual goal, which is, hey, I don't like the mask or whatever the person was. That doesn't move your ball, you know, any closer to your goal. It just pisses off some people. And I think it makes some people feel like we're crazy, you know, and just think that, like, oh, look at these crazy people. They're harassing more, you know, they're harassing workers. Like, I would rather, like, have a conversation with somebody if the opportunity arose and, like, say, hey, can I tell you why I don't think this is valuable or why I don't think this is useful? I know you don't have any control over it, but can I inform you about why we're doing this? You know, that seems more productive to me than just antagonizing people. You know, and especially, there's definitely an element to me that's fucking annoyed when it's people from other countries coming here to Mexico and they don't speak any Spanish and just berating people. You know what I mean? Like, there's definitely, unfortunately, some of that mentality. There could be kind of colonialist mentality in some people. And that's not at all the approach we're trying to take, like, with our movement out here. I'm not from Mexico. My partner's family is. My family's indigenous to Texas and have been there for generations. We want to work with the Mexican actors that are already here. And thankfully, it's been beautiful. We're seeing the beginnings. There's been two groups that have popped up in the last year, United for Truth and Mexicans for Truth, that are all Spanish-speaking, like, kind of groups talking about similar things. And one of them spoke at the Greater Reset. And so, yeah, we're really trying to work and collaborate with the community, not come in and say, hey, we've got all the answers. Let us take care of it, right? Like, and so, I don't know. It's just not my style.
There was a presentation that we were talking about that I don't know if they meant to word it like this, but it was like a real estate slideshow, and it said, like, own Mexico.
Oh, wow.
Which we were kind of laughing about. Like,
again, there's definitely... Was that at Anarcapulco?
Yeah.
It's not surprising.
So, can you tell me about the events that are happening right now in Acapulco?
Yeah, so there is multiple kind of festivals, conferences going on. One of them would be Anarcapulco, which has been going on for, I think, 8 years now here in Acapulco. And I spoke there in 2017, 2018, 2019. And then there's also, like, this side component kind of decentralized, what's currently being called Agorapulco, which is, again, the Agora, that word, if you've heard it around a lot, it's coming from agorism, from counter-economics, and this whole idea of exiting and building. And so it also tends to mean that the Agorapulco events are more decentralized, more community-oriented, sometimes free or much more affordable than some of the Anarcapulco events. Anarcapulco has, like, a higher cost to entry, and sometimes some would say maybe a focus more on money than some of the other community events. And, so Agorapulco is just the idea that if you want to come for Anarcapulco or just come out here and be around of other community people, you can host any workshop you want. You can put on a music event. You can give a talk. You can do a meditation. And so it's pretty cool because a lot of organic stuff just pops up. Like, there's like a juice cleanse thing going. There's meditation. I've given some workshops. There's music nights happening. And it's totally being organized just by people in the community who feel the call to share something outside of, like, what's going on with Anarcapulco.
Is it fair to say that people go to both events/all events?
I think some people go to both, yeah. And then also I would include the Greater Reset, which we had 2 weeks ago, into this as well now, because this is only our third event that we're doing, and it happens 2 weeks before this, so some people are kind of going to the Greater Reset.
Let me tee it up. So, like, what is the Greater Reset?
So the Greater Reset is, the full name is the Greater Reset Activation. It's an online and in-person event that I help co-organize that is a direct response to the World Economic Forum and their call for a Great Reset. You know, they've called for a reset of capitalism in June 2020, and in January 2021, when we launched our event, they had their Davos Forum in Switzerland, and they announced the full, you know, their full Great Reset initiative. And so our idea was, let's counter them by having 5 days of parallel events focused on similar topics, but from a decentralized kind of grassroots, bottom-up perspective.
So it's like an anarchist Davos.
Yeah, it's like the idea of, let's bring together all of our really empowered, educated people and share how are we going to talk about technology, but from decentralized perspective and the environment. All the same topics they cover, but instead of like a top-down, centralized, let's let the World Economic Forum plan the world kind of vision. It's more like, how can we as communities organize? And so it's definitely grown to become an international movement too. And so what I was saying is some people now will come to Mexico for the Greater Reset, and then 2 weeks later head down here to Acapulco for Anarcapulco and Agorapulco. So I've definitely seen faces that have been at all three things. And
how many people would you estimate are exiting their countries to build a new life in Mexico and also Latin America?
I mean, since August and September, we've seen, I would estimate, 5,000 to 10,000 people coming in, and a lot of them have been Canadians. Because in October, Canada passed some laws making it where you can't drive, you can't take buses or fly or take the train domestically without proof of vaccination. So a lot of people saw that coming and were like, we're getting out. And so, yeah, we definitely saw a flood of Canadians. There's been a lot of Australians who were able to get out because they have a very difficult time even getting out of their own country since COVID's been going on. And a lot of people coming from Europe. But I would definitely say I might even be underestimating, but I've seen through my own networks of helping people through our caravans, driving people down what we call the Underground Railroad, helping people come here, and then just people through the Freedom Cell Network, it's definitely somewhere 5,000 to 10,000 people, I'd say, that have made Mexico their home in different parts.
And so, do you think this is going to continue?
I do think so. I think this is just the beginning, honestly.
But the pandemic restrictions are loosening.
In some places, but just recently, like for example in the U.S., in Boston, they just announced that 12 years and older have to show proof of vaccination for gyms, restaurants, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So in some places it's loosening, like a lot of Europe, Netherlands, et cetera, but other places they're still as prominent. You know, it might not be in people's face, but the reason I think it's going to continue, regardless of even if, let's say, every single COVID measure was to disappear, there might be some people who decide, you know what, I'm going to go back home. I think things have calmed down. And I think that's probably already happened with some people. Some people who left the U.S. initially have now felt like, oh, well, Texas and Florida are chill. So, like, I'm just going to go home. Everything's fine or whatever, right? And that's fine. But for those of us who see that this is a bigger plan, like, the United Nations and the World Economic Forum talk about the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, Agenda 2030, which have one kind of public face, and then they have another face that many of us believe is the true purpose. And so that's 2030. We're in 2022. A lot of these agendas, COVID was just the excuse to accelerate the push to what Klaus Schwab, the head of the World Economic Forum, calls the Fourth Industrial Revolution, which is a push towards AI, social credit scores, facial recognition, blockchain being used in some really scary ways, and a lot of other technologies that are literally right on the cusp of emerging that are not happening organically and that COVID helped accelerate. You know, so that's a mouthful, but that's, you know, that vision, and many of us who hold that vision and see that vision is why, you know, I'm not going to go home even if things chill out. Like, I mean, I still travel back and forth as much as I can, but I don't operate under the assumption that, you know, a new variant could come and they could say it's the craziest thing since, you know, Delta, and we all need to lock down again, and most of the world will comply, you know. And so I don't anticipate whether it's a new variant or Bill Gates' predicted next pandemic or whatever the case may be, that these repercussions of COVID are going to go away. I mean, we now have like a mental health crisis with the rise in young girls committing suicide. You have several countries that have introduced measures that who knows if they're going to go away, but they granted themselves new emergency powers in the last 2 years that could be used in all kinds of different ways. So many of us see parallels between the laws that shifted after 9/11 and the laws that shifted after COVID.
I think a lot of people watching this, and even me personally, would kind of agree that, yes, a lot of governments did increase their surveillance and their authoritarianism during the COVID-19 pandemic. But why do we necessarily assume that's going to be permanent? And can't we work within the political system to create the outcomes that are better for everyone?
I think that history has shown that governments as a whole and just in general, the state is... I can't think of a time where the state relinquished power that it took under an emergency situation. Right? You know, there's a mantra that is repeated often, and it's originally a quote from Rahm Emanuel, former mayor of Chicago, who was in the Obama administration. And you can find the clip out there where he says, you know, you never want to let a good crisis go to waste. And that's pretty much how many of us believe that these individuals and organizations operate. So many people got rich off during COVID-19, like not to mention like Pfizer and those companies, but so many other companies that threw under the CARES Act, where you got your $1,200 check, you know, corporations are getting fat paid, and there's so much like the usual fuckery that goes on while people are just scared out of their minds of 9/11 or COVID or whatever else, that didn't stop in any way. I mean, companies got bigger, got stronger, And many people did benefit financially off of COVID, whatever your view of it, whether people take like a very mainstream view, it was the worst pandemic and whatever, or other people who say they don't even think it's real. Like, whatever position, the point is there is a lot of, I think, area that people can agree on that this time was taken advantage of by corporations and by governments. And I don't see a way, personally, I just think the system's too fucked to try to fix it within inside. Like, I mean, I don't see how you can achieve realistic, lasting change. Like, I take inspiration from my indigenous elders, and we are taught to think about the seven generations and beyond, right? And I don't see true lasting generational change coming from the institution of government. Like, I see at best like band-aids that might help for the next year or two while the ship's still breaking and falling apart, right? And, like, I want to create something that if I ever do have kids or for my nieces and nephews, that they have some other option. They can choose to live in this mainstream world, which will be technocracy, surveillance, social credit scores, probably masks and yearly COVID shots, or they can choose whatever the hell we're building, you know. And that's kind of where we see it, is that like either we're going to be passive and be swept up into this vision, or we're going to build something else and see what comes. I mean, that's kind of just how I'm approaching it.
What are people building, all the people that have exited to Mexico?
I think people are trying to either, there's like a range. Some people are just buying land for their families, right? Just little homestead plot. Others are trying to build intentional communities, eco-villages. The project that we're building is called, hola amigo. Our project is called the Conscious Agora. And it's very much based around like these ideas. I've been writing about it for a few years, and I had the vision to bring it into existence in 2020. COVID happened, and so we decided to come to Mexico to make it happen. But yeah, I mean, I think what I'm envisioning is a network of communities that are aligned under the principles of permaculture, under the idea of self-ownership and sovereignty of the individual, and then also with like a mindfulness angle, that we are also people that are trying to continuously still grow spiritually, mentally, physically, etc. And so those are like the cornerstones of this network that we're trying to build. Some people we're working with are in different parts of the country. Others are just doing their own thing, right? And there's just a lot of momentum happening. I think whatever ends up actually coming into existence right now, we'll see the fruits of it in the next 5 to 10 years or so.
Super interesting. I mean, do we need to do that again because of that? No, it's okay. Okay. To me, it feels like commune energy.
Like what?
Commune energy.
Commune energy?
Yeah.
How do you define a commune? Or what do you mean by that?
Like, it just, like, that's what I've been thinking ever since I started researching this. It just seems like, I feel like in 5 years, like, I'm going to call all the people I met at this trip back, and they're going to have, like, all set up, like, funky little communes that, like, some of which, like, are super organized and, like, going super well, and, like, others, like,
sure,
might have dissolved, and then others, yeah, might have turned into a cult. And,
I think you're right that there'll be a mix of circumstances. So there's this book called Creating a Life Together that is, like, an intentional community Bible that a lot of people are using as a study. These two women, they basically studied intentional communities for 30 years, and everything we learned. And they say in that book that 90% of intentional communities fail, and most of them fail because they never get off the ground. So, like, we've taken 2 years through our process. I use my work to say, hey, you want to help us build this project? We had 400 emails come in. We went through them. We sent out a questionnaire to all of them. Here's the principles that we want to build around. Here's some questions for you. We got about 200 responses. Miriam and I put that on a spreadsheet and narrowed it down to 50 people. And then September 2020, we started having bi-weekly calls with people all around the world, getting to know them. And over that time, it's just kind of naturally come down now to 7 households of people that we're working with. And we have the land in mind, but now we're just getting ourselves all sorted out. Because what I've seen is there's a lot of people definitely rushing here. There's unfortunately opportunity for people to get scammed and ripped off. Because, you know, anytime people are in a panic, there will be people who try to take advantage of it. And I've had people reach out to me and say, hey, we're a retired couple. Can we send you $100,000 for a spot in your land? And we don't even have the land yet. And so if I was less, you know, if I had less principles, then maybe I would take that money, right? So there's people who have gotten ripped off. There's people we've seen rush into like, hey, well, let's live together. And then they realize they have nothing in common, you know, nothing really aligning them. So I've learned a whole lot in the last 2 years about how this process is going to go. And I think there definitely will be people who don't get off the ground. There'll be people who succeed. There's for sure, I can see people already who are super passionate about this, who are maybe were already headed in this direction before COVID anyways, and now it's just advancing.
One person that comes to mind is Jackie of Neeklum.
Do you know her? He was telling me.
Okay, I talked to her on the phone, and she was saying that she had the idea to start this intentional community, or eco-village, I think they call it, you know, years ago, before COVID, yeah, because she was worried about vaccines, like, pre-COVID-19,
sure,
you know, and wanted a place to raise families that
had a different approach to medicine.
Yeah.
Because he mentioned the Underground Railroad, so I just wondered if you can explain like what that is and why they take that name.
Yeah, okay.
And then I have like two more, but I'll throw you them.
Okay, throw me them later. Okay. So you call your caravans out of Canada the Underground Railroad?
They're coming out of the U.S., yeah. Out of the U.S. We have people who come from Canada to the U.S., but yeah. It's called the Modern Underground Railroad / Counter-Economic Underground Railroad, and it's just terminology from my book, How to Opt Out of the Technocratic State. Again, I published that book at the beginning of 2020, and I was writing in there a chapter about how in a distant future, not too distant future, there might be a time where, like the original Underground Railroad, people sought, you know, to travel to places that they find more free or more amenable to their lifestyle. And what that means in the sense of, again, surveillance, facial recognition, social credit score. And so the idea was just theorizing that this might be necessary at some point in the future. And then COVID happened, and it kind of evolved to becoming a still totally legal and above the board thing for the moment, but just a way to, for Miriam and I, because we were making the trip back and forth to Houston to down to Mexico, so we started putting out the call. It's through the Freedom Cell Network, too. People sign up through there. They get an email that says, hey, there's a caravan coming up soon. If you're interested, you got to fill out this survey. There's a vetting process, but, and then we just help people who want to come down.
It just makes you wonder, the word Underground Railroad obviously has a lot of historical context, and it reminds me of a lot of conversations I've had this week with people who say, you know, in my home country in Canada or in the UK, like, I'm a slave. And I've also noticed that people who are moving here call themselves refugees.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of language that I think viewers watching might find inappropriate or a bit disrespectful to the original context of those words. I don't know if you want to speak to that.
A lot of people aren't aware that the original Underground Railroad had railways to Mexico as well, that slaves did escape to Mexico. And so for me, it's kind of a... I think it's like a continuation of that the same way, because I don't know how, I mean, whatever terms you want to use it, whether you want to call somebody a slave or a refugee or not, but people are, in some circumstances, Canada included, are literally running away from places where they can't work without getting the shot, they can't take their kids to school, they can't ride a bus, they can't take a plane, they can't, you know, and in some places, like France and other countries, people are being denied entry into grocery stores without proof of vaccination. Like, those are some pretty dramatic and most of us would say authoritarian things. And so I can understand why somebody who's literally trying to get away from a place like that might consider themselves a refugee.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean they're running away from the Syrian crisis per se, but I can definitely understand. I mean, I wouldn't want to be in that environment. And, you know, so I would probably choose to leave as well, even though those aren't my specific circumstances. But yeah. And then in terms of like using the Underground Railroad in terms of like slavery, in the book, it's more related to the idea that the Underground Railroad was an act of counter-economics, and without having to get too deep into the weeds of that, it's essentially saying that when the original conductors in the railroad helped slaves escape, they had to make a decision knowing that it was against the Fugitive Slave Act, that they could go to prison for it. You know, people took bribes, cops looked the other way to help people make their way on there. And in that same sense, many of us now feel like it's up to us, those of us who have the ability, to help other people who feel like they're escaping from situations that are not and minimal to freedom. Maybe you wouldn't call it abject slavery, you know, they're not chained by the hand. But yeah, I mean, so that, it was kind of more in the sense of like, this is an act of counter-economics because it's what the state says is illegal, and that's what agorism is all about. It doesn't matter if it's illegal, as long as it's non-violent, if it's moral, then do it. And in that sense, we feel helping people come, whether from the U.S. or Canada, down to Mexico is part of that goal.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like what is kind of underneath this conversation is, how do I phrase this? Like, when I talk to people who are at these events, the level of oppression that they describe around having to, you know, being asked to get a vaccine and being asked to wear a mask is, I think that people who do those things and didn't even think about them and just are, you know, follow the rules and blah, blah, blah. I think there's like, these two groups just don't understand each other at all. Because if you got your vaccine and you wear your mask to the grocery store, there's no realm of consciousness that you can see that as slavery.
Sure. And if you see it as slavery, it's just like, I don't see how these two things can be reconciled.
I do think we're living in different worlds. I've actually had this video in my mind for a while that I call the fracturing, which is what I think we're going through. I think that increasingly, I was sharing this earlier, that those of us who are, let's say, not vaccinating kids, not living in mainstream society, not having kids who are educated by the state-run education system, et cetera, and all these different ways that we are kind of separating, that those differences are going to become more and more stark as time goes on. That, like, we're living totally different realities, we live in totally different worlds, and that's why when people come to events like this, they can kind of let their guard down and just talk freely because they feel like they're around people who aren't going to judge them. They might be coming from a place where they have to wear both physical and metaphorical masks and not even be their real selves. And so I do think that we are increasingly living in a different reality that, like you said, somebody who does those things kind of casually without thinking too deeply about it might not feel like it's that big of a deal. But for others, it's like, to me, the question comes to mind is like, well, how long are you going to wear the mask? Are you just going to do it forever, like until they say it's okay not to? Because that's how some people are. They'll jump when they're told to jump and they'll stop when they're told to stop. And, you know, so that's kind of my thought on that.
I think you're right. I think it's interesting, though. I think the mask in particular is potentially an example because with the vaccines, I can understand if you think, for example, as many people have told me this week, that the COVID-19 vaccine is lethal. And I personally think that it's life-saving. Well, then we're never going to have the same opinion about the requirement to get it. Does that make sense?
It does. And it's unfortunate, though, because to me, hearing those things of somebody who admits, which is the truth, that people have died from the COVID shot, that even the EU this week announced that after a year of people talking about menstrual problems and all kinds of things that were called fake news and disinformation, the EU finally announces they're going to listen and investigate it. That if you have somebody who on the other side is like, that's not true, it's life-saving, if you're not willing to hear each other, then yeah, there's no conversation to be had. But if two people can sit down and say, hey, let me show you the information I'm looking at, and yeah, maybe somebody, and I would guess some people at these events don't have the best quality information and data always, right? And I think it goes both ways. There's some people who are like, but look, CNN reported it. It's fact. That's it. That's all there is, right? So, but if the problem is, and I think this is where that fracturing is coming in, is if we can't rectify that and find a way to communicate, and we all know social media isn't the place. Like, that's not the way to, like, I haven't really convinced or converted anybody through my social media debates, right? Like, I haven't, but more than likely.
Do you debate people?
I try not to. I mean, I try not to get sucked into this shit because it's like, you know, at this point, there's too many people, even with it, like, you got people who hate you from within the movement and people who from outside the movement who think you're crazy, right? So you gotta choose your battles. But my point is that, like, the times that I have been able to have a face-to-face and a real honest, not like, hey, we're going to try to get over on each other, I'm going to smash my point down your throat kind of thing, then there is room for growth. But it seems increasingly like that's not what's happening. Instead, we're forming our own festivals, we're forming our own communities, we're saying, like, okay, if mainstream society rejects us, we're going to form our own thing. And that's basically what's happening.
Yeah, it is very interesting. I mean, I think I don't know if you want to speak to, like, the evolution of counterculture. I feel like the political camps that have, you know, historically in the 20th century been, like, countercultural and mainstream are really, like, in flux. And I frankly don't know where we've landed. What do you think?
I think that, well, for one, I'll say specifically as far as politics go, that the traditional left-right paradigm doesn't make any sense anymore. And that, I mean, for example, I'll just give you this brief story. I met a gentleman here who is what he would consider himself to be a leftist. Like, maybe even he might use the term progressive. But around these issues, he's homeless. He can't find very many other leftist progressives who are willing to look at the VAERS reports, who are willing to listen to the people who are talking about vaccine injuries, who are, you know, looking into these different things or the problems with the PCR test. And so instead, he's kind of ostracized by what he felt was his political home, right? And so I think in those ways, like, people who, for many of us, the left has become the authoritarian side. The right is just as capable as authoritarianism. Of course, I don't align with either. But there are situations when it comes to COVID that the left, because they are so pro-science and dogmatic about it, what many of us consider to be a religion of scientism, they, you know, follow the science, trust the science, listen to the experts, which is the whole technocratic philosophy that there should be technological elites and experts ruling society. They kind of brought us into that because people on the left have such a affinity to what they believe is, like, hard science, facts, and this sort of thing. Questioning the science around COVID has kind of, you know, made people who traditionally would feel at home on the left feel like they don't align there anymore, right? So I think in that sense, the political spectrum is all fucked up, but I also do think culturally you have the COVID divide happening like in spiritual communities as well. Like it happened in the spiritual community too, where some like yoga communities, etc., some might be for the masks and they make their students come with masks. Others are like, we're not doing that, and that was like another big divide. There's been like this, it's cut across a lot of, I think, subcultures and sub-communities online and in the real world, of depending on which side of the discussion you fell on, you know?
So you think COVID is readjusting and completely... So you think COVID is reformatting subcultures and rearranging, like, who is aligned with each other?
I think in some ways. I mean, I was just talking to a woman who said she's been living in an intentional community for 4 years, and she's committed there. She's got her life there, her money invested, etc. But, again, COVID divided that community. Some people very much about masks, etc., other people against it, and she's now having to, like, what do I do? Do I go back into this community? You know, and I think that's just one example of what a lot of people are dealing with, whether that's in personal relationships or business relationships, etc. People who have questions about COVID definitely have gotten the message that it's not okay to say this out loud. You know, if you say this out loud, you're going to be ostracized. You're going to be treated differently. You're going to be called crazy, anti-science, etc. And so some people choose to just be quiet and go along to get along. But others who've chosen to vocalize their feelings or their thoughts or even just questions like, hey, guys, I don't know if this adds up to me, have found their whole kind of subculture experience, counterculture experience, I turned upside down. And maybe it is being redefined right now.
The final one for me, basically, and we've gotten at this in different ways, but I feel like we've seen, like, Mexicans are almost better at mask wearing than Americans, and we often see more Mexicans wear masks, and it's also obligatory in some businesses. So very kind of like, what is it that people who move to Mexico feel like they can do here that they can no longer do in their own countries?
Yeah, so is it just like, what's the appeal of Mexico? Or?
Yeah, what is it that brings people here that they feel, you know, like, what is the freedom that they have here that they don't have Mexico?
Okay, and do you want the context of...
You can, if you want to, but...
Okay, Mexico does have pandemic restrictions, and mask compliance here is actually pretty high. What do you think people who are relocating here from places like Canada and Australia, what is the freedom that they're really finding?
So I've been here for the entire pandemic, and I never once got locked down. I've never been forced to wear a mask. I've never had to deal with a curfew. I've never had any real change to my normal life. And even coming from Texas, things were pretty normal, you know, in some places. But yeah, I never had any sort of in-your-face, like, restrictions. But Mexico is also a big country. I will say that some people come here thinking that, like, Mexico's this totally COVID-free, no restrictions or whatever, and they come here and they get discouraged because they're in a place that people are wearing masks, or maybe certain towns have tried curfews, right? But the thing about Mexico specifically being, you know, a third-world country, as some people like to term it, people can't afford to not work. So when they try lockdowns, even when the government makes an official pronouncement, literally within a week or two, nobody pays attention. It goes away because the people can't afford to just stay home. They can't afford to go, you know, lock down at 7 p.m. or whatever. And I've seen it where we lived, where it lasted for one weekend, maybe 2 weekends at best, and then everything went back to normal. And that's kind of been the case around the country. So even if they're publicly making pronouncements, it doesn't necessarily mean that things on the ground are like that. And then the other thing, because we're making an effort to talk to Mexicans, we go out and we pass out flyers about COVID and about masks. And one of the things we realize is that a lot of Mexicans, because the term conspiracy theorist doesn't really exist out here, they haven't been propagandized in that same way. They're a lot more receptive. In the U.S., everybody's too busy to go in, or they think you're trying to sell them something, or they read it and they think you're crazy. Whereas Mexicans are a lot more receptive. And we've found people who, while they're wearing masks, they don't trust the vaccines at all. They have a lot of questions. You know, they might not be out here acting as activists or wearing a shirt about the vaccines, but within their family or within their circles, they have questions. So I don't know that a mask is, and this is what I've said to our community as well, like, I don't think a mask is an indicator of somebody who's compliant to, you know, what they're being told necessarily. Some people just don't want to be bothered, you know. I'm lucky that in Mexico, there's enough local markets that I don't have to go to any big box corporate stores that are going to try to make me wear a mask. I was saying, so I'm lucky that in Mexico where we live, there's enough local organic markets that I don't ever have to go to a Walmart or any kind of big box stores. And in Mexico, those are really the only places that are trying to make you put a temperature scan to your head or wear a mask, or other than Oxos. Like, it's all the corporate stores, but the small local stuff, it doesn't even, you don't even have to deal with it.
Which is, like, not really your vibe anyway, since you're into corporate.
Yeah, it's not really what I would be shopping in the first place. Now, where we're filming right now happens to be a food desert that there isn't a lot of that options like there isn't a lot of Mexico. So, but, I mean, you see that nobody here is asking anybody to wear a mask to go into a restaurant or anything like that, by and large. Like, maybe if we went to some of the fancier hotels and retreats, we might get some of that. But that's kind of how the Mexico approach is. When it's more, like, local, maybe it's just because they want the money or they just don't care. It's hard to know.
Fun. Okay. I'm just looking, like, at the questions I originally wrote down.
What time is that, guys?
5:40.
So we need to wrap up pretty soon.
Yeah.
Well, do you have anything else that you want to talk about, or do you have something you want to ask me?
No, I mean, I think that I appreciate your questions, and I appreciate you guys taking the... It's funny because I've been telling people through my social media for the last 2 years, I don't think people realize the exodus that is happening right now. And there haven't been many people actually taking the time to say, like, let's document what's happening here, because it's been happening, like, the first a little trickle when COVID started, and it's been picking up a lot. So it's just cool to see anyone actually noticing this story happening here.
I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, I think whether people agree or not, that they likely will find it intriguing, and it's just, it's what's happening, you know? So one way or another, we're out here, we're doing this thing, and it's happening around the world as well. Mexico's just a hot spot at the moment, you know?
Is this utopian, what's happening?
I don't think so, not for me. I mean, I don't have any visions of utopia. I don't know if there is such a thing. And I think it's possible for us to create lives that feel more free or liberating or rewarding for ourselves and the communities that we're involved in. But I don't have any hopes or visions of utopia. Humans are flawed whether we're working for the government or not.
I guess I just feel like the desire to not participate in society as it exists and instead start one's own, to me that feels like a definition of utopia.
I mean, some might see it that way, but I think it's just this confluence of the fact that there is technology that is radically and rapidly changing the world for both good and bad purposes. There's a lot of people here who place their faith in crypto and blockchain to potentially replace institutions like government and stuff like that. There's also a lot of scary things happening with technology. So I feel like those factors, the combination of people worrying about vaccines and all this kind of agenda coming together, is like, hey, let's just build something new. Let's take the tools that we have available to us and see if we can do better and see if we can create something better. And I mean, a lot, I'm sure you guys have seen this, a lot of these people have families. These are like, you know, it's not just like a bunch of young 20-something, there's that, but there's also people who are in their 40s and 50s who've got families, got grandkids, and are really trying to think about what comes next for them, you know? And like I said, I don't have any kids, but I'm definitely thinking like longer term, like this is pretty much what I'm going to be doing for the next 60 years, is committing my life to this and seeing where it goes.
Do you have residency in Mexico?
I'd rather not talk about that.
So no.
Yeah, let's not talk about that.
Okay, well, I'm just letting you know what I'm assuming the answer is.
Sure, that's fine. That's fine.
Well, okay, I was going to ask you how you were going to get it.
I don't know if I'll go down that road.
Okay, interesting.
Can we move to a wine shot? Are you okay with that?
Yeah.
We can keep the conversation going.
No, that's chill.
Some white.
This isn't... Like, this doesn't really matter, but if we're talking about the fracturing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like, I think, like I was saying, like I actually do understand like the fracturing a lot. Like, I understand why there's such a dissonance around the vaccine based on what you believe it does. Like, obviously,
it's pretty big.
Of course.
Yeah.
The mask thing, I don't get as much because I feel like nobody, even people who are like the most compliant and docile, like according to like whatever their rules are, like even that they like you know, nobody's wearing their mask all the time, and like you're only being required to wear it in like, you know, it's a limited time, and then you take it off. You know what I mean?
I mean, I think it's more about for what. Hey, babe, you okay? We're almost done.
They're just getting a wide shot. Is it weird if his mic is in the shot or?
So I can move this.
Since 2012, the Conscious Resistance Network has been an independent media organization focused on empowering individuals through education, philosophy, health, and community organizing. We work to create a world where corporate and state power do not rule over the lives of free human beings. Our motto is leading by example and helping others in their pursuit of freedom. Visit theconsciousresistance.com to find our articles, documentaries, interviews, podcasts, books, and more. Remember, you are powerful, you are beautiful, and you are free.